Welcome to In My Own Words. I'm your host, Wes, and this is the final word in media. I have expert modelers predicting that by next week, my audience will grow 100-fold. Therefore, I think it's only reasonable for me to explain what this show is. Here at IMO, I review various types of media, from film, television, internet, and everything in between. All of that is delivered with a hint of opinion, a dash of controversy, and a few good jokes sprinkled in here and there. All of that and so much more delivered in my own words. Let's get started. That's right. We're back. This one's going to be a doozy. I've been looking forward to this one for quite a while. You see, today, we're talking about some of the best that television has to offer. And during this bizarre quarantine, we have all had a lot more time spent in front of the television. Perhaps we found something worth watching, or maybe not. Either way, some have called this time in history television's second golden age. Maybe it is, but one thing is sure. The last two decades have given us some of the most memorable television series we've ever seen. In this special three-part series, I'll be diving into that which Mom said would rot your brain. It's time to sneak out of the living room, grab some chips, soda, and plop on down 2 inches from that staticky old box. We're talking about television comedies and what makes them tick. Let's start out with, of course, the granddaddy of modern television comedy, Friends. So what made Friends so popular? It's a good question. You see, the series ran from 1994 to 2004. And there was this new cultural idea being seen in media about the friends are the family you choose. And this idea of a bunch of mid-20-somethings having this near-familial relationship with each other was very popular and very approachable, and it persists to this day. You see, it's not the first group sitcom that's ever been created, but it defined a special period of American history. See, while the characters might be a little bit flat, a little bit one note in their nature, they were all very fleshed out to the point of believability. At first, the humor was creative during the early years and, similar to Seinfeld, filled the world with even more bizarre side characters. These side characters suffer from the typical one-episode, short-term memory lapse. Unfortunately, this dates the show in the world of binge-watch and streaming-style viewership. The characters give off a feeling of genuine care for each other, if lacking any empathy for anyone else in the Friends universe. One of the favorite memories that I have from watching Friends when I was a lot younger than I am now is the 2 or 3 episode buildup for Chandler's proposal to Monica. And that summarizes the best trait of Friends. It captures the feeling of nostalgia, whether it's your first time watching or your 100th viewing of any given episode. Friends is an entire world built around nostalgia. The entire world of the show gives one of a few emotions to every viewer. And this is every single episode. You'll feel one of these, I guess. There's several. Memories of lost love, memories of successful love, memories of hanging with pals, memories of terrible jobs, memories of good or bad dates, memories of loneliness, yet having a handful of buddies to get you through it, and memories of, well, sarcasm. I mean, could you be any more nostalgic? In all seriousness, Disney drools over having this much nostalgia-driven entertainment. Sure, later entries that we'll be discussing have that pandering of nostalgia, and it's no surprise that entertainment as a whole attempts to capitalize on your rose-colored memories, but good lord, if you watch Friends with an objective critique, It is mostly nostalgia-driven plot lines and jokes. Now, before you riddle my inbox with hate, I will say that in between seasons 3 and 6, you have most of Friends' best humor. While major plot lines are still derivative, many of the jokes within the episodes are built upon a character's genuine traits. That is an actual comedy writing skill. This would be the difference seen between these two episodes, the one where Ross and Rachel take a break, and the one with the cuffs. In the earlier episode, Rachel is working very late and incredibly hard, but Ross wanted to be romantic, so he ruins her work night by showing up with picnic supplies. Later, of course, the two part ways, beginning the epic "We Were on a Break" running joke. Now, contrast that plot with the latter episode, where Rachel discovers Chandler engaging in a sexy rendezvous with her boss by finding him handcuffed and pantless to her boss's chair. These plots are very similar. Rachel wants to impress her boss. She wants to do everything she can to achieve professional success and be on her boss's good side. And both feature another character jeopardizing her professional ability by placing her between a rock and a hard place, which she explicitly warned them about earlier in that episode. It's amazing how they just repeat these plot lines, isn't it? But these episodes differ in two key ways. Ross is performing all the usual weak-willed, wannabe romantic boy antics we've seen a thousand times before. This entire episode is built off of tropes we've seen work in romantic movies, so much so that we are immediately filled with memories of romantic success. Later, when Rachel gets mad, we are filled with even more nostalgic of failed romantic endeavors. Now, when looking at Chandler's being caught with his literal pants down, we see Rachel having to decide who she should help, her sexually promiscuous boss or the in-over-his-head, if not a little degenerate, friend, Chandler. In order to understand Rachel's response, reasoning, and decisions, you have to actually know Rachel. In order to get why Chandler ended up here, you have to know Chandler. It is not so easy to find this episode funny. You have to already have a relationship with these characters to enjoy the comedy. Though the jokes are still funny if you've never watched an episode of Friends, they are so much more powerful and, well, hilarious if you have a long-term relationship with the show. To sum up, Friends works best when the characters are given the freedom to be their crazy selves. These six characters are some of the most memorable and extreme in television history. When the writers give them the room to go ham in the stories, you get some of the best comedy. And you know the cast is good for it. Heck, they were being paid $1 million an episode in the last two seasons. Which is kind of sad, considering our next point. You see, those last two seasons were some of the worst. But why were they? The plots became about dramatic topics, as well as the derivative nature of the characters' actions. Also, a massive amount of filler. Game of Thrones fans understand the frustration brought about by a slow, dragging season 7, then a breakneck season 8. This plagued the show in all aspects, thus diminishing the talent on the show. Basically, what happened was the show focused way too much on the major plot points, like Ross and Rachel's relationship woes, rather than the lighthearted, wacky comedy such as a pantless Chandler. So how could they have remedied that issue? What if they never even had a major plot? What if there was a mirror television series with a more cynical but just as hilarious take on modern American friend groups? What I'm asking is, have you heard about a show about nothing? Sorry, let me start that over again. That very familiar bass riff, which, fun fact, the sound designer made all of those odd noises himself. Interesting. Either way, that familiar bass riff begins our next segment about Seinfeld, one of my favorite shows of all time. Running from 1989 to 1998, this show about nothing truly paved the way for the postmodern absurdist comedy, which would change how the world viewed entertainment. Interesting enough, it actually ran earlier than Friends, but the ideas and concepts utilized by the producers were well ahead of its time. Jerry Seinfeld's character portrayal of himself would become one of television's first anti-heroes, which I'll touch on that more with the dramas episode I will be releasing. So what made Seinfeld work? Seinfeld follows four friends, quote-unquote, who are absurdly selfish. They are just as selfish as the characters of Friends, yet they are never framed in any kind of redeeming light. They lack any empathy and seem to please only their most immediate desires. In other words, they're just normal people. And that is why it works. Most episodes follow a very loose plot, which sees the characters deal with life's mundane complications in a selfish, almost wish-fulfillment manner. Almost every episode sees the four characters reach their comeuppance by the end of that very episode. These loose plots, however, are the show's true charm. Following almost a Shakespearean arc where the four characters' several stories interconnect and build into a hilarious climax, that's the true comic genius that the creators Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld bring to the forefront. To give an example of this loose plot, let's look to one of the show's more popular plot lines, George's marriage. At the beginning and throughout the seventh season, George is engaged to a character named Susan Ross. He laments being engaged almost immediately after proposal, but due to his inability to admit wrongdoing, he neglects to call it off. At one point, George even begins dating the actress Marissa Tomei, playing herself, but she dumps him once she finds out he is technically engaged. In this darkest episode of Seinfeld ever, the show breaks new ground by airing a sitcom in which a character is killed off as a joke. At the beginning of the episode, named The Invitations, George and Susan are shopping for wedding invitations. The sample binder is arranged by price. George hilariously flips directly to the cheapest and picks the oldest one available. George spends the entire episode attempting to get Susan to break off the wedding, from attempting to smoke or force her to sign a prenup. None of these attempts work, driving George into a deep depression. Inevitably, Susan begins licking each individual envelope, eager for her wedding day. During this time, Jerry meets a woman who is exactly like him in every way, and they begin dating. After only a little while, he proposes to her. After she accepts, Jerry immediately regrets this decision, just as George had been the entire season. Many of these lines and shots are mirroring several previous episodes that featured George and his lamentations. Susan, however, has been licking the envelopes for a very long while. The show cut to her throughout most of the B-plot. Suddenly, she passes out. George walks in on her unconscious body, then rushes her to the hospital. While all four friends wait in the hospital with George, a doctor walks out and says that Susan has in fact died from the cheap old glue on the cheap envelopes. The group is silent, yet uncaring. George seems relieved, and they all go nonchalant to their usual restaurant at the end of this season. Boy, oh boy, what an episode. This showed the world that you can have a mainstream black comedy be successful. At the time, this was a controversial episode, but has gone down as one of history's most memorable episodes of television. But the idea of a negative character, considered the protagonist, was novel for this time period. Applying the old Western film archetype to a modern situation comedy was revolutionary. Up until this time, sitcoms always had a positive message or role models. Maybe they were silly drunks, goofy dads, or fresh princes, but the morals of the shows were positive. When Seinfeld showed the world you could entertain the audience with, and even have them root for, a terrible anti-hero. Without Seinfeld, television wouldn't be what it is today. Additionally, Seinfeld is an anomaly in that it only got better with each season. Apart from a lackluster finale, the show never had a just don't watch the final season moment. The reason is because it never changed. The show had a truly episodic nature, so one could watch a season 2 episode, then a season 6 episode, and they will be very similar. You wouldn't be lost diving into any episode of Seinfeld, which I encourage you to do. And I should mention that Curb Your Enthusiasm, the theme I played earlier, is the exact same show, only following Larry David, who is the George character in his original show. It is the same, because of that, highly enjoyable. So if you have HBO and you like Seinfeld, then dive in and give it a watch. I promise you won't be disappointed, unlike finding out that your long-lost father is just a mediocre magician. That's right, we're talking about one of my favorite sleeper hit shows, Arrested Development. Airing from 2003 to 2006, and then again in 2015, and then again in 2018 for some reason, Arrested Development fundamentally changed the landscape of comedy. This was the original show to use the multi-camera mockumentary style for comedic formula. The dysfunctional family is a rather traditional setup, yet Arrested Development flipped this idea on its head. It was the complete deconstruction of the explosive, yet wealthy family which grew out of the world post-9/11. While simultaneously running the worst few seasons of Friends, one could watch a fast-paced, self-referential Arrested Development, where Friends made bank by preying on the tried-and-true nostalgic formula, Arrested Development capitalizes on the completely unfamiliar. This show was unbelievably ahead of its time, thus influencing the creation of latter shows such as The Office, Parks and Rec, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and so much more. In case you unfortunately haven't seen the show, I want you to know that the original three seasons are phenomenal and showcase a near-perfect execution of comedy. The series builds, and for the best understanding, you have to watch it from beginning to end in order. The jokes are fast-paced and perfect for watching on Netflix. It seems the show was tailor-made for streaming before streaming was ever even an idea. As a result of this style, it is almost impossible to explain how funny this show is by referencing. It builds and grows with every episode, mocking the wealthy, obtuse, and ridiculous upper-class family of the Bluths, a real estate family whose fortune is jeopardized by the patriarch's crimes coming back to haunt him. This results in the estranged yet arrogant family being forced to live together in their only shared property, a model home in a non-existent neighborhood. Additionally, a major joke of the series is the fact that the only vehicle they can afford to drive is an airport stair car, which can only go roughly 45 miles an hour. It also constantly has hop-ons of strangers hitching a ride around town. The familial cast of absurd characters are showcased through the eyes of the straight man, which is Michael Bluth, played by Jason Bateman. His selfish, criminal, and passive father, George Bluth, is played by Jeffrey Tambor. His controlling, cruel, and manipulative mother, Lucille Bluth, is played in expert fashion by Jessica Walter. His magician, dramatic, lazy, and idiot savant brother, Joe Bluth, is played by Will Arnett. His other brother, who is childish, cartoonish, and a major mama's boy, Buster Bluth, is played by Tony Hale. His elitist, greedy, beauty-driven twin sister, Lindsay Funke, is played by Portia de Rossi, Lindsay's husband and Michael's brother-in-law, is a failed psychiatrist who believes he should be an actor, though he's terrible at it. Regardless of his lack of skill, he also spends most of the screen time uttering double entendres hinting at a closeted homosexuality. This is Tobias Funke, played by David Cross. Lindsay and Tobias's daughter, the conniving, scamming, brilliantly devious and wise beyond her years, maybe Funke, played by Elia Shawkat. And finally, there is Michael's son, who lacks all ability to socialize, is barely street smart enough to keep up with his criminal family, yet is utterly brilliant in the classroom. Also hides a secret attraction to his own cousin, maybe, George Michael Bluth, played by Michael Cera. Now, we need to talk about this fourth and fifth season, which aired over a decade later on Netflix, in 2015 and 2018, respectively. You can imagine why these took so long and are spread out, considering who that cast is. They are all stacked with A-list comedic actors who all have films coming out nearly every year. However, the two new seasons seem to have a hollow take on the glory days of the original series. I will say that the best part of the new series was the editing choice for season 4. The original cut is a strange mashup which has each episode follow only one character. The episodes overlap, giving eureka moments to viewers who see a strange shot somewhere along the way, and then 3 episodes later, we'll find out what that shot meant and why it happened and who the characters involved were. The concept of this weird edit was built upon the new trend of binge-watching a series. When binge-watched in its entirety, season 4 is comparable to the original series. It feels like an 8-hour reunion episode of Arrested Development. Many fans, however, did not like this editing choice, and a remix was later released with a more traditional styled show. A lot of the great recurring jokes were cut due to editing decisions, and it made an overall disappointing season. Now, season 5 followed suit and ends on a rather bleak and depressing note, mirroring a real-life issue with the cast. You see, Jeffrey Tambor lost his job on another show on Amazon due to sexual harassment allegations, as well as many cast members of Arrested Development alleging similarly aggressive sexual behavior. Thus, the lackluster ending of season 5 seems, at the moment, to be the final nail in the coffin of the show, which seemed to be on the edge of cancellation throughout its life. Never making the cut originally due to being ahead of its time, and later due to conforming to current trends. I guess you could say Fox and Netflix didn't know that there is always money in the banana stand. Oh yeah. If you haven't heard this before, that is Robin Sparkles. Great hit from Canada. With her smash single, Let's Go to the Mall. For some of you, that is incredibly familiar. You see, that's from How I Met Your Mother, which ran from 2005 to 2014. This is one of the most culturally important sitcoms for a generation. Some of the early 2000s most quotable episodes and jokes were crafted by the expert writing from How I Met Your Mother. This show took the layout and design of a traditional sitcom but flipped it on its head by applying the humor style, episode concepts, and plot devices used by Arrested Development. How I Met Your Mother depicts a definitive shift away from the laugh traditional style, applying the success of the cutaway gag, as well as numerous running gags and motifs. Now, I'm going to list a few of these numerous running jokes, and that was the charm of the show, so there is a significant amount that I will not have, and yet, this is a very long list. And a lot of you are going to have eureka moments when I say some of these. Suit up, son of a bitch, let's go to the mall. This is an intervention. Red cowboy boots, which I totally pull off. A bang, 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 bangity bang, a bang, 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 The Wedding Bride. Hilarious movie. Eating a Sandwich, Kids, which I would never do. Slaps Giving, Doppelgangers, The Highest of Fives, The Bro Code, Yellow Umbrella, Blue French Horn, Canada Needs Real Money, The Pineapple Incident, I Would Walk 500 Miles, and Have You Met Ted? I'm sure just by listing those, I have given you an example of just how powerful the nostalgia technique is when viewing some of these shows. The concept for the show, unique enough, didn't keep the series away from the ill-fated decision to end on a horrific note, however. While the show's strongest moments are not the gag-like cutaway humor or running gags, but in fact are its saddest, darkest gut punches that end many episodes. The theme of life usually circling back around to an often unpleasant reality persists throughout the show, which was a great clue throughout that the ending would not be a traditionally happy ending. Real quick, I'm going to list some of the most powerful endings to check out, not all negative, but really some of the best episodes that they made. The Final Page, The Time Travelers, Legend Daddy, Last Words, Symphony of Illumination, The Longest Second, and Bad News. So after all of those powerful episodes, were we surprised the mother and spoiler alert, were we surprised that the mother ended up being dead? No. Were we disappointed that it ended up really just being Robin who got with Ted after everything and all that on again, off again nonsense? Yes. For the same reason that we were okay with the mother being dead. The overall moral of How I Met Your Mother is that life doesn't work out at all how you plan. And sometimes life isn't fair. Often, the only good things in life are the close friends and family members that we get to go through all of it with. And one day, you can tell all about those stories when you get older to your kids. It's up to you that those stories be legend. Wait for it. Dairy. Now, let's keep this train rolling with The Office.
You took me by the hand, made me a man. That one night, you made everything all right.
Finally, we get to the kingpin of television comedy. This show, along with Breaking Bad, ushered in this golden age of television that I brought up earlier. You see, The Office found the middle ground of comedy where one could have outrageous behavior and situations while grounding these larger-than-life characters in a realistic setting with genuine heart. The Office seemed to garner some of that nostalgia I was talking about earlier, yet it seemed to create its own nostalgia. This is something television shows could work for years to attain and still fail. Simply hearing the opening theme brings a sense of calming joy to every viewer. So what made this show work so well? The characters were all familiar. And by that I mean the writers designed the characters originally to showcase traits we all have. There are days we are Pam and we're being harassed by Angela. There are some days where we feel like Jim pranking Dwight. Some days you're season 4 Michael, meeting the love of your life, Holly. But some days you're also season 1 Michael, having to fire an employee on a holiday and knowing you'll be hated forever for the tough decision. This kaleidoscopic approach to characters is where The Office shines. And the rejection of this technique is what killed the show in the long run. But we'll get there later. During The Office's first season, Michael, played by the only actor able to play this character, Steve Carell, was designed to be the pseudo-villain of the show. This made the audience uncomfortable with his character. I always theorized that Michael was too much like a genuinely cruel or terrible boss. Americans won't sit around and watch a show reminding them of their terrible job. it would just be another half hour of that job at night when you're home. This almost cost NBC one of their greatest titles. So the show creators came up with their 80-20 rule. 80% of the episode would paint Michael as an unintentionally terrible boss. 20% would show him as well-intentioned and his employees being nice to him. This brilliant decision created the almost familial tone the rest of the series would have. You weren't watching coworkers drudging through the work week, you were watching a family hang out and work through life's challenges. Now, to contrast the talent of the early season with the latter flop that the series took, I want to remind you of a point from when I discussed Friends. Easy comedy is familiar plot devices and nostalgia-driven plot devices. Skilled comedy takes original characters that drive the original plot. In seasons 1 through 5, The Office had a wacky cast of characters coexist in a small enclosed ecosystem. The small space drove the plot to be based on the circumstances and reasons for their interaction, rather than some guest star coming in and changing the flow. Yes, The Office does heavily rely on the new love, lost love, nostalgia, but the best jokes and even the most memorable episodes don't require those moments to succeed. But later in seasons 6 through 9, our characters are slowly changed. Removing Michael, we are greeted by a motley crew of regular changes. The constant change completely removes the need for the characters to drive the plot. Rather, the predictable television tropes must take center stage. Which trope was the breaking point? That would be Jim and Pam's marital issues, resulting in Pam's near-adulterous relationship with the freaking cameraman of the show. I don't know what the producers were thinking with this terrible idea and completely mishandles the show and the characters we've known forever. Terrible. And for that reason, I'm out. But those flaws are few and far between. To demonstrate how much of an emotional impact the series had, I'm just going to list quotes, and you'll be able to experience the waves of memories this show can bring. Sometimes I'll start a sentence, and I don't even know where it's going. I just hope I find it along the way. One day, Michael came in and complained about a speed bump on the highway. I wonder who he ran over then. I want people to be afraid of how much they love me. Whenever I'm about to do something, I think, would an idiot do that? And if they would, I do not do that thing. If I can't scuba, then what's this all been about? Webster's defines wedding as the fusing of two metals with a hot torch. But before we move on, remember, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. Wayne Gretzky, Michael Scott.
Up in horsey heaven, here's a thing. You trade your legs for angels' wings. And once we've all said goodbye, you take a running leap and you learn to fly.
We're there. We are at Parks and Recreation, which ran from 2009 to 2015. This was a very fun series created by Michael Schur, who also created The Office. Parks and Rec has the same great tone that The Office carries throughout. What separates Parks from The Office and Brooklyn Nine-Nine, another Schur production, is that its story flows in a fantastic blend of serial and episodic series. In other words, the series seems to have the least amount of filler of any show on this list, but rather makes each episode count towards the story. Maybe it isn't much more than displaying a character trait we already knew about, but even those weaker episodes provide growth in one way or another. Additionally, I would say this show borrows more from Arrested Development than The Office, with the multi-camera cutaways being more of a hindrance than a crucial story point. In fact, I would say the series could do without any of the fourth wall breaks. The series is at its best when the group of characters are interacting to solve a problem in the absurd world of Pawnee local government. The storylines are structured in a way that shows the writers put about 99% of their time into the A story for most episodes. Basically, what I'm saying is that the B stories usually can be cut out entirely. If you've never given Parks and Rec your attention, do what I did. Start with the final episode in Season 2 and go from there. For whatever reason, Season 1 seemed to shackle the hilarious characters to some kind of grounded status, which hinders the best parts of the show. Also, Adam Scott and Rob Lowe didn't arrive until then. Those actors literally brought the show to another level, especially bringing Rob Lowe's intense domination of every scene he's in. With the hyperactivity brought by Rob Lowe, every character seemed to grow into a hyperactive and highly enjoyable version of themselves. You see, the show removed its need for the stereotyped straight man, which has been present in every show we've discussed so far. Instead, Parks and Rec revels in its absurdity and holds itself in its own world of comedy, kickstarting the age of absurdism in American comedy. Speaking of absurdism, let's move on to our final show that we'll be discussing, the only comedy to actually mock other comedies. The only one to take the absurdism and postmodernism to its final stage of being an anti-comedy. The only show to still be airing. This fall, it will be starting its 15th season. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, running from 2005 to the present day. Holy moly, this show is ridiculous. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia follows Dennis, Mac, Charlie, and Dee, as well as Dee and Dennis's father, Frank, who all run the unsuccessful Patty's Pub. The gang, as they call themselves, are a warped version of the American sitcom group, having weekly adventures which take dark turns. You see, the premise of Sunny is that if you take a cast of sitcom characters, but place them into a genuine reality, you will be watching a gang of egocentric, degenerate sociopaths harming all those around them. They won't be heroes. In fact, they will be incredibly selfish, and if anything, they're the villains of their own stories. But wow, is this show hilarious? You do have to have an acquired taste to really stomach this show, and I will say it is TVMA. It is the only show on this list I really would not watch with your children. In fact, some of the episodes might make you a little squeamish. That's a little bit the point. Every major point that I have discussed as a positive for comedy series, however, is implemented in the best way in Sunny. The series never relies on a fake nostalgia for jokes or impact. The series never gives up the opportunity for a joke, no matter how offensive or dark the punchline may be. The series grows and must be watched in order to fully get every joke, because characters outside of the gang remember and grow and have to consistently deal with the gang, who seems to be stuck in this television purgatory to fester with themselves. Each character has a dark or secret trait, which is hinted at for the sake of comedy. I'm going to read them to you, and just because they sound horrible does not mean that they're not funny. The show has a way of taking such terrible things and dressing them up in a comedic light, but I'm going to read them anyway. So just brace yourself. Dennis, the leader of the gang, is often hinted at to be a serial killer, manipulator, and all-around deviant, similar to that of Ted Bundy. Mac, an arrogant wannabe athlete and strict Catholic, is hinted at to be a closeted homosexual. Charlie, the fool of the gang, and the funniest of everyone in the show, is hinted to be a secret savant who has killed so many rats he's warped his view of the world. Dee, which is Dennis's twin sister, believes herself to be a performer, but can't sing or dance, has horrendous stage fright. She is the most grounded of the gang, yet her selfish desires for fame make her step on anyone she dislikes. And Frank, Dee and Dennis's father, is a wealthy gun nut that acts like a 14-year-old with self-destructive tendencies. The gang is horrible. And the show makes no question that they are not the typical sitcom gang of misfits who are actually good. In fact, Sonny takes the worst parts of all the friends from Friends and puts them on full display. The near egotistic nature of their sociopathy displayed in the show, Friends, is mocked and disassembled before your eyes with cutting satire in Sonny. Another key to their success is that the characters all have a completely fleshed out nature to them. Rob McElhaney, Glenn Howerton, Mac and Dennis respectively, created and write the show. Their friend, Charlie Day, Charlie in the show, writes some episodes as well. Dee, played by Caitlin Olsen, is Rob McElhaney's wife in real life. And Charlie's neurotic love interest, known only as Waitress, is played by his real-life wife, Mary Elizabeth Ellis. As a result of this blended acting and writing, the cast is able to fully delve into their absurd characters, tailoring the cast to the actors phenomenally. It always felt like you were watching a show made by a group of friends, just goofing off and writing what they think the funniest thing would be. Yet, this group of friends is incredibly talented. Also, Danny DeVito plays Frank, and he's an American treasure. Now, we're getting a little long on time here, so I'm going to wrap all of this up. To summarize, humor is subjective, and it's okay if you hate every one of these shows. It's also okay if you hate everyone. But life's better if you can find the little bit of humor everywhere in life, even in its absurdities. To make this point, I'll let Dayman from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia play me out. Have a good week, everybody. If you liked this episode, make sure you subscribe and let your friends and family know to keep up with my latest episode from In My Own Words. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and you can email us at imowpodcast@gmail.com. Remember to #spread the word. See you next time, everybody.